calculated plutonium's cross-section for slow neutron fission at 1.7 times that of U-235. When Lawrence heard the news on Monday, says Seaborg, he swung into action. We told Lawrence about our definitive demonstration yesterday of the slow neutron fissionability of 94-239, and he was quite excited. He immediately phoned the University of Chicago to give the news to Arthur H. Compton. Compton made an immediate attempt to phone unsuccessfully and then sent a telegram to Vannevar Bush. In his telegram, Compton indicated that the demonstration greatly increases the importance of the fission problem since the available material, that is, U-238 transmuted to plutonium, is thus increased by over 100 times. He said that Alfred Loomis and Ernest Lawrence accordingly have requested him to urge anew the vital importance of pushing the uranium graphite work at Columbia. Whenever the U.S. program bogged down in bureaucratic doubt, Hitler and his war machine rescued it. That summer's massive escalation, codenamed Operation Barbarossa, was the opening of the Eastern Front at dawn on the morning of Sunday, June 22nd. A surge eastward with 164 divisions, including Finnish and Romanian components, toward Blitzkrieg invasion of the USSR. The Führer's ambitious intention, declared with emphasis in a secret directive 6 months earlier, was to crush Soviet Russia in a quick campaign, even before the conclusion of the war against England. Hitler meant to push all the way to the Urals before winter and commandeer the Soviet Union's industrial and agricultural base. By July, panzers had crossed the Dnieper and were threatening Kiev. The effect on Conant of his London experiences and the widening war was paradoxically to increase his skepticism of the program he had just accepted assignment to administer. What worried me about Compton's first report, I told Bush, was the assumption that achieving a chain reaction was so important that a large expenditure of both money and manpower was justified. To me, the defense of the free world was in such a dangerous state that only efforts which were likely to yield results within a matter of months, or at most a year or two, were worthy of serious consideration. In that summer of 1941, with recollections of what I had seen and heard in England fresh in my mind, I was impatient with the arguments of some of the physicists associated with the Uranium Committee, whom I met from time to time. They talked in excited tones about the discovery of a new world in which power from a uranium reactor would revolutionize our industrialized society. These fancies left me cold. I suggested that until Nazi Germany was defeated, all our energies should be concentrated on one immediate objective. Having experienced the London Blitz, Conant had developed a siege mentality. Bush, as Conant points out, was faced with a momentous decision as to priorities. Both men wanted a hard, practical assessment. They decided Compton's report needed an injection of common sense in the form of engineering expertise. Compton discreetly retired from the line. W.D. Coolidge, the General Electric scientist, temporarily took his place. Conant added an engineer from Bell Laboratories and another from Westinghouse, and early in July the enlarged committee reviewed the first review. Briggs was a convincing witness. By then he had received the April 9 minutes of a Maud technical subcommittee meeting where Peels reported that cross-section measurements confirm the feasibility of a fast neutron bomb. Briggs had also just learned from Lawrence that plutonium had a cross-section for fast fission some 10 times that of U-238. Lawrence even submitted a separate report on element 94 that emphasized for the first time in U.S. official deliberations the importance of fast fission over slow. But Briggs was still preoccupied with a slow neutron chain reaction for power production, and so was the second NAS report. In the summer of 1941, John Dunning's associate Eugene Booth remembers, Briggs visited us in the basement of Pupin at Columbia to see our experiment for the separation of U-235 by gaseous diffusion of uranium hexafluoride. He was interested, blessed us, but sent us no money. The American program was in danger for its life that summer, Compton thought. The government's responsible representatives were very close to dropping fission studies from the war program. He believed the program was saved because of Lawrence's proposal to use plutonium to make a bomb. The feasibility of 94 may have convinced Compton. It was not decisive for the government's responsible representatives. They were hard men and needed hard facts. Those began to arrive. More significant than the arguments of Compton and Lawrence, writes Conant, was the news that a group of physicists in England had concluded that the construction of a bomb made out of uranium-235 was entirely feasible. The British had been trying all winter and spring to pass the word. In July, they tried again. G.P. Thompson had assembled a draft final report for the Maud Committee to consider on June 23rd, the day after Barbarossa exploded across the Balkans and eastern Poland. Charles C. Lawrenson of Caltech, a respected senior physicist, was beginning work for the NDRC developing rockets and happened to be in London conferring with the British at the time of the Maud draft. The committee invited him to attend its July 2nd meeting at Burlington House. Lawrenson listened carefully, took notes, and afterward talked individually with 8 of the 24 physicists now attached to the work. When he returned to the United States the following week, he immediately reported the Maud findings to Bush. In essence, says Conant, he summarized the draft report. The physicists Lauren had interviewed had all pushed for a U.S.-built gaseous diffusion plant. The British government would not officially transmit the final Maud report to the United States government until early October, but the committee approved it on July 15th, and thereupon promptly disbanded. And by then, Bush had been passed a copy of the Thompson draft, which embodied the essential findings. The Maud report differed from the 2 National Academy studies as a blueprint differs from an architect's sketch. It announced, at the outset, "We have now reached the conclusion that it will be possible to make an effective uranium bomb, which, containing some 25 pounds of active material, would be equivalent as regards destructive effect to 1,800 tons of TNT, and would also release large quantities of radioactive substances. A plant to produce 2.25 pounds, 1 kilogram per day of U-235, or 3 bombs per month, is estimated to cost approximately £5 million. In spite of this very large expenditure, we consider that the destructive effect, both material and moral, is so great that every effort should be made to produce bombs of this kind. The material for the first bomb could be ready by the end of 1943. Even if the war should end before the bombs are ready, the effort would not be wasted, except in the unlikely event of complete disarmament, since no nation would care to risk being caught without a weapon of such destructive capabilities." Of conclusions and recommendations, the report offered, crisply, 3. 1. The committee considers that the scheme for a uranium bomb is practicable and likely to lead to decisive results in the war. 2. It recommends that this work continue on the highest priority and on the increasing scale necessary to obtain the weapon in the shortest possible time. 3. That the present collaboration with America should be continued and extended, especially in the region of experimental work. With the news from Great Britain unofficially in hand, Conant concludes in a secret history of the project he drafted in 1943, it became clear to the director of OSRD and the chairman of NDRC that a major push along the lines outlined was in order. They still did not immediately organize that push. Nor was Conant, to his post-war recollection, yet convinced that a uranium bomb would work as described. British research and considered judgment had at least proposed a clear-cut program of military development. Bush took it to Vice President Henry Wallace, his White House sounding board, who was the only scientist in the cabinet, a plant geneticist who had developed several varieties of hybrid corn. During July, writes Conant, Bush had a discussion with Vice President Wallace about the question of spending a large amount of government money on the uranium program, after which Bush apparently decided to wait for official transmittal of the final Maud report. "If each necessary step requires 10 months of deliberation," Leo Szilard had complained to Alexander Sachs in 1940, "then obviously it will not be possible to carry out this development efficiently. The American program was moving faster now than that, but not by much." While Lawrence and Compton championed plutonium that summer, a big, raw-boned, war-battered Austrian hiding out within the German physics establishment tried to keep the fissile new element out of sight. He was an old friend of Otto Frisch. Fritz Haudermans and I had met in Berlin, but in London before the war, I saw a lot more of that impressive eagle of a man, half Jewish as well as a communist, who had narrowly escaped the Gestapo. His father had been a Dutchman, but he was very proud of his mother's Jewish origin and liable to counter anti-Semitic remarks by retorting, "When your ancestors were still living in the trees, mine were already forging checks." He was full of brilliant ideas. Haudermans had taken a PhD in experimental physics at Göttingen, but was strong in theory. One of his brilliant ideas, developed in the late 1920s at the University of Berlin with a visiting British astronomer, Robert Atkinson, concerned the production of energy in stars. Atkinson was familiar with recent estimates by his older colleague, Arthur Eddington, that the Sun and other stars burn at temperatures of 10 million and more degrees and have lifespans of billions of years, a prodigious and unexplained expenditure of energy. On a walking tour near Göttingen in the summer of 1927, the two men had wondered if nuclear transformations of the sort Rutherford was producing at the Cavendish might account for the enduring stellar fires. They quickly worked out a basic theory, as Hans Bethe later described it, that at the high temperatures in the interior of a star, the nuclei in the star could penetrate into other nuclei and cause nuclear reactions, releasing energy. The energy would be released when hot, and therefore fast-moving, hydrogen nuclei collided with enough force to overcome their respective electrical barriers and fuse together, making helium nuclei and giving up binding energy in the process. With George Gamow, Haudermans and Atkinson later named these events thermonuclear reactions because they proceeded at such high temperatures. In 1933, Haudermans emigrated to the Soviet Union, but fell victim, writes Frisch, to one of Stalin's purges and spent a couple of years in prison. His wife and two small children managed to escape and get to the USA. When Hitler made his temporary pact with Stalin in 1939, it included an exchange of prisoners, and Haudermans was handed back to the Gestapo. Max von Laue, whom Frisch celebrates as one of the few German scientists with the prestige and courage to stand up against the Nazis, managed to free Haudermans and arranged for him to work with a wealthy German inventor, Baron Manfred von Arden, who had studied physics and who maintained a private laboratory in Lichterfeld, outside Berlin. Von Arden was pursuing uranium research independently of Heisenberg and the War Office. To raise funds for the work, he had approached the German post office, which commanded a large and largely unused budget for research. The Minister of Posts, imagining himself handing Hitler the decisive secret weapon of the war, had funded the building of a million-volt Van de Graaff and two cyclotrons, all under construction in 1941. Until they came online, Haudermans turned his attention to theory. By August, he had independently worked out all the basic ideas necessary to a bomb. He discussed them in a 39-page report on the question of unleashing chain reactions that considered fast neutron chain reactions, critical mass, U-235, isotope separation, and element 94. Haudermans emphasized making 94. Every neutron which, instead of fissioning uranium-235, is captured by uranium-238, he wrote, creates in this way a new nucleus, fissionable by thermal neutrons. He discussed his ideas privately with von Weizsacker and Heisenberg, but he saw to it that the post office kept his report in its safe, secure from War Office eyes. He had learned to cooperate for survival in the Soviet Union, where the NKVD, the KGB of its day, had knocked out all his teeth and kept him in solitary confinement for months. But in Germany, as in the USSR, he withheld as much information as he dared. His private endorsement of 94, to be transmuted by chain reaction from natural uranium, probably contributed to the neglect of isotope separation in Germany. After the summer of 1941, the German bomb program depended entirely on uranium and Vemork heavy water. The British, at least, knew where they were going. Tizard was skeptical of the Maud report and doubted that a bomb could be produced before the end of the war. Lindemann, he was Lord Cherwell now, a baron, courtesy of his friend the PM, did not. Cherwell had followed the Maud work carefully. He respected Thompson. Simon was an old friend. Peerls had read his grunts correctly after all. He trusted their judgment and set to work to reduce the lengthy report to a memorandum for Churchill. Churchill liked his documents held half a page. So important was this one that Cherwell allowed it to run on for 2.5 pages. He thought research should continue for 6 months and then face further review. He thought an isotope separation plant should be erected not in the United States, but in England, despite manpower shortages and the risk of German bombing, or at worst, in Canada. In that conclusion, he differed from the Maud Committee. "The reasons in favor of an English location," he wrote, "are the better chance of maintaining secrecy. But above all, the fact that whoever possesses such a plant should be able to dictate terms to the rest of the world. However much I may trust my neighbor and depend on him, I am very much averse to putting myself completely at his mercy. I would, therefore, not press the Americans to undertake this work." His summation narrowed the odds, but decisively raised the stakes. "People who are working on these problems consider the odds are 10-1 on success within 2 years. I would not bet more than 2-1 against or even money. But I am quite clear that we must go forward. It would be unforgivable if we let the Germans defeat us in war or reverse the verdict after they had been defeated." Churchill received Cherwell's recommendation on August 27th. 3 days later, he minuted his military advisers, alluding ironically to the effects of the Blitz. "Although personally I am quite content with the existing explosives, I feel we must not stand in the path of improvement, and I therefore think that action should be taken in the sense proposed by Lord Cherwell." The British Chiefs of Staff concurred on September 3rd. Mark Oliphant helped goad the American program over the top. "If Congress knew the true history of the atomic energy project," Leo Szilard said modestly after the war, "I have no doubt but that it would create a special medal to be given to meddling foreigners for distinguished services, and Dr. Oliphant would be the first to receive one." Conant, in his 1943 Secret History, thought the most important reason the program changed direction in the summer of 1941 was that the all-out advocates of a head-on attack on the uranium problem had become more vocal and determined, and mentioned Oliphant's influence first of all. Oliphant flew to the United States in late August. He considered the Pan-American Clipper through Lisbon too slow, and usually traveled by unheated bomber, to work with his NDRC counterparts on radar. But he was also charged with inquiring why the United States was ignoring the Maud Committee's findings. "The minutes and reports had been sent to Lyman Briggs, and we were puzzled to receive virtually no comment. I called on Briggs in Washington, only to find that this inarticulate and unimpressive man had put the reports in his safe and had not shown them to members of his committee." Oliphant was amazed and distressed. He met then with the Uranium Committee. Samuel K. Allison was a new committee member, a talented experimentalist, a protege of Arthur Compton at the University of Chicago. Oliphant came to a meeting, Allison recalls, and said, "Bomb," in no uncertain terms. He told us we must concentrate every effort on the bomb, and said we had no right to work on power plants or anything but the bomb. The bomb would cost $25 million, he said, and Britain didn't have the money or the manpower, so it was up to us. Allison was surprised. Briggs had kept the committee in the dark. "I thought we were making a power source for submarines." In desperation, Oliphant reached out to the most effective champion he knew in the United States. He wired Ernest Lawrence. "I'll even fly from Washington to meet at a convenient time in Berkeley." At the beginning of September, he did. Lawrence drove Oliphant up the hill behind the Berkeley campus to the site of the 184-inch cyclotron where they could talk without being overheard. Oliphant rehearsed the Maud report, which Lawrence had not yet seen. Lawrence, in turn, proclaimed the possibility of electromagnetic separation of U-235 in converted cyclotrons and the virtues of plutonium. "How much I still admire the way in which things are done in your laboratory," Oliphant would write him after their meeting. "I feel quite sure that, in your hands, the uranium question will receive proper and complete consideration." Back in his office, Lawrence called Bush and Conant and arranged for Oliphant to see them. From Oliphant, he collected a written summary of the secret British report. In Washington, Conant took Oliphant to dinner and listened with interest. Bush met him in New York and gave him a barely courteous 20 minutes. Neither administrator admitted to knowledge of the Maud report. "Gossip among nuclear physicists on forbidden subjects," Conant characterizes Oliphant's peregrinations in his secret history. Oliphant also stopped by to talk to Fermi. He found the Italian laureate more cautious than ever, noncommittal about the fast neutron bomb, and not altogether happy about the Bohr-Wheeler theory of fission. Before or after his meetings in Washington and New York, Oliphant visited William D. Coolidge, the temporary chairman who produced the second NAS report, at General Electric in Schenectady. That visit at least stirred something like indignation. Coolidge immediately wrote Jewett of Oliphant's news, emphasizing for pure U-235 that the chain reaction in this case would take place through the direct action of fast neutrons. This information, so far as I know, was not available in this country until after the National Academy Committee had sent in its second report. I think that Oliphant's story should be given serious consideration. Information had indeed been available in the United States, at least the Maud minutes, including Peierls' April 9 statement. But Briggs had locked it away for safekeeping. Oliphant returned to Birmingham, wondering if he had made any impression at all. Lawrence was already moving. He called Arthur Compton in Chicago after Oliphant left Berkeley. "Certain developments made him believe it would be possible to make an atomic bomb," Compton paraphrases the conversation. "Such a bomb, if developed in time, might determine the outcome of the war. The activity of the Germans in this field made it seem to him a matter of great urgency for us to press its development." It was no more than Szilard had argued 2 years earlier. Lawrence was scheduled to speak in Chicago on September 25th. Conant would be in town to receive an honorary degree. Compton proposed to invite both men together to his home. Lawrence could then press the NDRC chairman directly. Following his decision for political commitment at the Pan-American Scientific Conference, Edward Teller had continued teaching at George Washington University, but sought work in fission research. In March 1941, with Merle Tuve as one of their sponsors, the Tellers swore allegiance to the United States and became American citizens. Hans Bethe, who was teaching at Columbia for the spring term on temporary leave from Cornell, took the oath the same month. At the end of the term, Bethe recommended that Columbia invite Teller to replace him, to work more closely with Fermi and Szilard, and to adjudicate their disputes, which he did with sensitivity. Teller accepted and moved to Manhattan, to an apartment on Morningside Drive. In the midst of experiment, Fermi found time to theorize. He and Teller had lunch at the University Club one pleasant day in September. Afterward, walking back to Pupin, out of the blue, Teller says, Fermi wondered aloud if an atomic bomb might serve to heat a mass of deuterium sufficiently to begin thermonuclear fusion. Such a mechanism, a bomb fusing hydrogen to helium, should be three orders of magnitude as energetic as a fission bomb, and far cheaper in terms of equivalent explosive force. For Fermi, the idea was a throwaway. Teller found it a surpassing challenge and took it to heart. Teller liked to break new ground. When he understood something theoretically, he usually moved on without waiting for experimental confirmation. He understood the atomic bomb. He moved on to consider the possibility of a hydrogen bomb. He made extensive calculations. They were disappointing. I decided that deuterium could not be ignited by atomic bombs, he recalls. Next Sunday, we went on a walk, the Fermis and the Tellers, and I explained to Enrico why a hydrogen bomb could never be made. And he believed me. For a while, Teller even believed himself. Enrico Fermi and Edward Teller were not, however, the first to conceive of using a nuclear chain reaction to initiate a thermonuclear reaction in hydrogen. That distinction apparently belongs to Japanese physicist Tokutaro Hagiwara of the Faculty of Science at the University of Kyoto. Hagiwara had followed world fission research and had conducted studies of his own. In May 1941, he lectured on super-explosive U-235, reviewing existing knowledge. He was aware that an explosive chain reaction depended on U-235 and understood the necessity of isotope separation. Because of the potential application of this explosive chain reaction, a practical method of achieving this must be found. Immediately, it is very important that a means of manufacturing U-235 on a large scale from natural uranium be found. He then discussed the linkage he saw between nuclear fission and thermonuclear fusion. If by any chance U-235 could be manufactured in a large quantity and of proper concentration, U-235 has a great possibility of becoming useful as the initiating matter for a quantity of hydrogen. We have great expectations for this. But before the Japanese or the Americans could build a hydrogen bomb, they would have to build an atomic bomb, and in neither country was major support yet secure. It was a cool September evening, Arthur Compton remembers. My wife greeted Conan and Lawrence as they came into our home and gave each of us a cup of coffee as we gathered around the fireplace. Then she busied herself upstairs so the three of us might talk freely. Lawrence spoke with passion. He was very rigorous in his expression of dissatisfaction with the U.S. program, writes Conant. Dr. Oliphant had seen him during the summer, and by recounting the British hopes, had further fired Lawrence's zeal for more action in this whole field. Conant knew all about the British hopes, knew talk was cheap, and chose to play the devil's advocate, easily gulling Compton, who thought his arguments turned the tide. Conant was reluctant. As a result of the report so far received, he had concluded that the time had come to drop the support of nuclear research as a subject for wartime study. We could not afford to spend either our scientific or our industrial effort on an atomic program of highly questionable military value when every ounce of our strength was needed for the nation's defense. I rallied to Lawrence's support. Conant began to be convinced. I could not resist the temptation, says Harvard president, to cut behind Lawrence's rhetoric by asking if he was prepared to shelve his own research programs. Compton cranks Conant's challenge to high melodrama. If this task is as important as you men say, Conant remarked, we must get going. I have argued with Vannevar Bush that the uranium project be put in wraps for the war period. Now you put before me plans for making a definite, highly effective weapon. If such a weapon is going to be made, we must do it first. We can't afford not to. But I'm here to tell you, nothing significant will happen on such a job as this unless we get into it with everything we've got. He turned to Lawrence. Ernest, you say you were convinced of the importance of these fission bombs. Are you ready to devote the next several years of your life to getting them made? The question brought Lawrence up with a start. I can still recall the expression in his eyes as he sat there with his mouth half open. Here was a serious personal decision. He hesitated only a moment. If you tell me this is my job, I'll do it. Back in Washington, Conant briefed Bush on what he calls the results of the involuntary conference in Chicago to which I had been exposed. The two administrators decided to order up a third National Academy report, enlarging Compton's committee this time to include W.K. Lewis, a chemical engineer with an outstanding reputation for estimating the potential success at industrial scale of laboratory processes, and Conant's Harvard colleague George B. Kistiakowsky, the resident NDRC explosives expert. Tall, big-boned, boisterous with a flat Slavic face and abiding self-confidence, Kistiakowsky had volunteered at 18 for the White Russian Army and fought in the Russian Revolution. "I grew up in a family in which the question of civil rights, human freedom, was an important one," he told an interviewer later in life. "My father was a professor of sociology and wrote articles and books on the subject and got into trouble with the Tsar's regime, very substantial trouble. Mother was also politically oriented. I think both of them went through a short period of being Marxists and then rejected it. That's why I really joined the anti-Bolshevik armies in 18. It was certainly not because I loved Tsarism. Of course, I got completely disgusted with the White Army long before it was all over." Kistiakowsky escaped to Germany and took his doctorate at the University of Berlin in 1925. He might have stayed, but his professor advised him to look elsewhere. "He told me that if I wanted to go into an academic career, I should emigrate. I would never get a job in Germany. Here you will always be a Russian." Princeton accepted the Ukrainian chemist on a fellowship and soon hired him for its faculty. Then Harvard discovered and courted him. In 1930, he moved, becoming professor of chemistry in 1938. Conant had been among those who lured Kistiakowsky from Princeton to Harvard. He valued highly his friend and fellow chemist's opinion. "When I retailed to him the idea that a bomb could be made by the rapid assembly of two masses of fissionable material, his first remark was that of a doubting Thomas. 'It would seem to be a difficult undertaking on a battlefield,' he remarked." But it was Kistiakowsky's judgment that finally convinced Conant, as British hopes and physicists' entreaties had not. A few weeks later, when we met, his doubts were gone. "It can be made to work," he said. "I am 100% sold." My doubts about Briggs's project evaporated as soon as I heard George Kistiakowsky's considered verdict. I had known George for many years. I had asked him to be head of the NDRC Division on Explosives. I had complete faith in his judgment. If he was sold on Arthur Compton's program, who was I to have reservations? Oliphant convinced Lawrence. Lawrence convinced Compton. Kistiakowsky convinced Conant. Conant says Compton's and Lawrence's attitudes counted heavily with Bush. But more significant was the Maud Report, which G.P. Thompson, now British Scientific Liaison Officer in Ottawa, officially transmitted to Conant on October 3rd. On October 9th, without waiting for the Third National Academy of Sciences review, Bush carried the report directly to the president. Franklin Roosevelt, Henry Wallace, and the director of the OSRD met that Thursday at the White House. In a memorandum Bush wrote to Conant the same day, he makes it clear that the Maud Report was the basis for the discussion. "I told the conference of the British conclusions." He told the president and the vice president that the explosive core of an atomic bomb might weigh 25 pounds, that it might explode with a force equivalent to some 1,800 tons of TNT, that a vast industrial plant costing many times as much as a major oil refinery would be necessary to separate the U-235, that the raw material might come from Canada and the Belgian Congo, that the British estimated the first bombs might be ready by the end of 1943. Bush tried to explain that an atomic bomb plant would produce no more than 2 or 3 bombs a month, but doubted if the president took in that relatively low yield. He emphasized that he was basing his statements primarily on calculation with some laboratory investigation, but not on a proved case, and therefore could not guarantee success. Bush was presenting essentially British calculations and British conclusions. Such a presentation made it appear that Britain was further advanced in the field than America. The discussion therefore shifted to the question of how the United States was attached or might attach itself to the British program. "I told of complete interchange with Britain on technical matters, and this was endorsed." Bush explained that the technical people in Britain had also formulated policy, had proposed that the government develop the atomic bomb as a weapon of war, and had passed their formulations along directly to the War Cabinet. In the United States, Bush said, an NDRC section and an advisory committee considered technical matters, and only he and Conant considered policy. Policy was the president's prerogative. As soon as Bush exposed it to view, Roosevelt seized it. Bush took that decision to be the most important outcome of the meeting and put it emphatically first in his memorandum to Conant. Roosevelt wanted policy consideration restricted to a small group. It came to be called the Top Policy Group. He named its members: Vice President Wallace, Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson, Army Chief of Staff George C. Marshall, Bush, and Conant. Every man owed his authority to the president. Roosevelt had instinctively reserved nuclear weapons policy to himself. Thus, at the outset of the U.S. atomic energy program, scientists were summarily denied a voice in deciding the political and military uses of the weapons they were proposing to build. Bush accepted the usurpation happily. To him, it was simply a matter of who would run the show. It left him on top and inside, and he put it to use immediately to shoulder the physics community into line. Within hours, as he wrote Frank Jewett in November, he had emphasized to Arthur Compton and his people the fact that they are asked to report upon the techniques and that consideration of general policy has not been turned over to them as a subject. Significantly, Bush associated the reservation of policy with relief from criticism. Much of the difficulty in the past has been due to the fact that Ernest Lawrence, in particular, had strong ideas in regard to policy and talked about them generally. I cannot bring him into the discussions, as I am not authorized by the president to do so. He applied just this test, silence on policy, to measure Lawrence's and Compton's loyalty. I think Lawrence now understands this, and I am sure that Arthur Compton does, and I think our difficulties in this regard are over. A scientist could choose to help or not to help build nuclear weapons. That was his only choice. The surrender of any further authority in the matter was the price of admission to what would grow to be a separate, secret state with separate sovereignty linked to the public state through the person and by the sole authority of the president. Patriotism contributed to many decisions, but a deeper motive among the physicists, by the measure of their statements, was fear. Fear of German triumph. Fear of a thousand-year Reich made invulnerable with atomic bombs. And deeper even than fear was fatalism. The bomb was latent in nature as a genome is latent in flesh. Any nation might learn to command its expression. The race was therefore not merely against Germany, as Roosevelt apparently sensed. The race was against time. There are indications in Bush's memorandum that Roosevelt was concerned less with a German challenge than with the long-term consequences of acquiring so decisive a new class of destructive instruments. We discussed at some length after war control, Bush wrote Conant, together with sources of raw material. Sources of raw material were then believed to be few and far between. Whoever commanded them might well, it seemed, monopolize the bomb. Roosevelt was thinking beyond developing bombs for the war that the United States had not yet entered. He was thinking about a military development that would change the political organization of the world. Bush, who was a successful administrator partly because he knew the limits of his charter, then suggested that a broader program, industrial production, ought to be handled when the time came by some larger organization than the OSRD. Roosevelt agreed. Summarizing his assignment, Bush told the president he understood he was to expedite in every possible way the necessary research, but was not to proceed with any definite steps on this expanded plan until further instructions from him. He indicated that this was correct. The money, the president told him, would have to come from a special source available for such unusual purpose, and he could arrange this. The United States was not yet committed to building an atomic bomb, but it was committed to exploring thoroughly whether or not an atomic bomb could be built. One man, Franklin Roosevelt, decided that commitment, secretly, without consulting Congress or courts. It seemed to be a military decision, and he was commander-in-chief. Bush and Conant proceeded to order up from Arthur Compton a third NAS review. Compton asked Samuel Allison for the name of someone who could help him calculate the critical mass of U-235. Allison had been corresponding with Enrico Fermi on the subject of carbon absorption cross-sections and recommended him highly. Compton called on Fermi in his office at Columbia University. Stepping to the blackboard, he worked out for me, simply and directly, the equation from which could be calculated the critical size of a chain-reacting sphere. He had at his fingertips the most recent experimental values of the constants. He discussed for me the reliability of the data. Even the most conservative estimate showed that the amount of fissionable metal needed to affect a nuclear explosion could hardly be greater than 100 pounds. Compton moved on to Harold Urey's office to look into isotope separation. Urey was the recognized world leader in the field as a result of his Nobel Prize-winning work with hydrogen isotopes. He had directed isotope separation studies for the Uranium Committee and the Naval Research Laboratory since the beginning. He personally investigated chemical separation of U-235, which turned out to be impossible given the chemical compounds of the day, and separation by centrifuge. Estimating that a centrifuge plant that would produce 1 kilogram of U-235 per day would require 40,000 to 50,000 yard-long centrifuges and would cost about $100 million. He had recently contracted with Westinghouse in the name of the Uranium Committee for a prototype unit. Urey was initially skeptical of gaseous barrier diffusion. He and John Dunning were not compatible, perhaps because they were both enthusiasts, and only when centrifuge development was well underway in late 1940 did Urey turn his attention to the process that Dunning and Eugene Booth were working hard at their own expense to develop. They had chosen gaseous diffusion at dinner one evening in 1940 on their way home from a trip to Schenectady by systematically ruling out other methods as unsuitable for large-scale production, much as Pearls and Simon had done. They were interested in nuclear power, Booth remembers, not bomb-making. Our reasons for pursuing the isotope separation path toward power production were simple and general. If a chain reaction became possible with normal uranium, a smaller and probably cheaper power plant could be made with enriched uranium. Dunning and Urey produced a joint appraisal of the gaseous diffusion process in November 1940. Dunning's barrier material at the time was fritted glass, partially fused and therefore porous silica, the material from which porcelain is made, which uranium hexafluoride was likely to corrode. They estimated that a gaseous diffusion plant would involve some 5,000 separate barrier tanks, stages, but made no attempt to determine cost and power requirements. By the autumn of 1941, without official support, Dunning and Booth had nevertheless made significant progress. They had switched to brass barriers from which the zinc had been etched. Brass is an alloy of copper and zinc. Etching away the zinc made the material porous. In November, the month after Compton's visit, they would successfully enrich a measurable quantity of uranium with their experiment. Compton traveled next to Princeton to see Eugene Wigner, who had been working closely with Fermi. Wigner clarified for Compton the difference between fast and slow neutron fission. He endorsed the uranium graphite system Fermi was developing as a method for producing 94. "He urged me," writes Compton, almost in tears, "to help get the atomic program rolling. His lively fear that the Nazis would make the bomb first was the more impressive because, from his life in Europe, he knew them so well." Back in Chicago, Compton talked to Glenn Seaborg, who had come east from Berkeley at Compton's request. Seaborg was confident he could devise a large-scale, remote-controlled technology for separating 94 chemically from uranium. Armed with this new round of information, Compton called a meeting of his committee for October 21st in Schenectady. He prepared for the meeting by writing a draft report. A letter came from Lawrence saying he wanted to bring along Robert Oppenheimer. "I have a great deal of confidence in Oppie, and I'm anxious to have the benefit of his judgment in our deliberation." Conant had scolded Lawrence at Compton's fireside when he learned that Lawrence had asked Oppenheimer, still an outsider, for help with theory. But now Lawrence's request was granted. A dispute between Lawrence and Oppenheimer about what Lawrence called the theoretician's left-wandering activities almost excluded him from the atomic bomb project. Oppenheimer, married now to the former Catherine Poenning, known as Kitty, with a 6-month-old son, had begun to wish for assignment. Many of the men I had known went off to work on radar and other aspects of military research, he testified later. I was not without envy of them. He learned the price of admission when he invited Lawrence to an organizational meeting at his elegant new home on Eagle Hill for a professional union, the American Association of Scientific Workers, of which Arthur Compton, among others, was a senior member. Lawrence wanted no part in any causes and concerns, as he called political activities, and barred his staff as well. I don't think it's a good idea, he told them. I don't want you to join it. I know nothing wrong with it, but we're planning big things in connection with the war effort, and it wouldn't be right. I want no occasion for somebody in Washington to find fault with us. Oppenheimer was not so easily put off. He debated Lawrence's point, arguing that humanity was everyone's responsibility, and that the more fortunate should help underdogs. The Nazis came first, Lawrence countered. He told Oppenheimer about Conant's scolding. Oppenheimer reserved judgment. The October 21st meeting, where he could measure the scientific leaders of the uranium program against his own formidable gifts, changed his mind. It was not until my first connection with the rudimentary atomic energy enterprise, he testifies, that I began to see any way in which I could be of direct use. When he saw his way to war work, he quickly sacrificed his underdogs, writing Lawrence on November 12th, I assure you that there will be no further difficulties at any time with the AASW. I doubt very much whether anyone will want to start at this time an organization which could in any way embarrass, divide, or interfere with the work we have in hand. I have not yet spoken to everyone involved, but all those to whom I have spoken agree with us. So you can forget it. Lawrence opened the Schenectady meeting by reading Oliphant's summary of the Maud Report. Compton followed with a review based on his October travels. Oppenheimer weighed in during the discussion of U-235's critical mass with an estimate of 100 kilograms, 220 pounds, close to Fermi's estimate of 130,000 grams. Kistiakowski, writes Compton, explained the great economic advantage of being able to deliver a heavy blow with a bomb carried by a single plane. But Compton was distressed to discover he could not move the engineers on the review committee, the practical souls Bush had insisted be added to bring the NAS reviews down to earth, to estimate either how much time it would take to build a bomb or how much the enterprise would cost. With one accord, they refused. There weren't enough data. The fact was that they had before them all the relevant information that existed, and some kind of answer was needed, however rough it might be, for otherwise our recommendation could not be acted upon. After some discussion, I suggested a total time of between 3 and 5 years and a total cost of some hundreds of millions of dollars. None of the committee members objected. So the American numbers came out of a scientist's hat, as the British numbers had. Atomic energy was still too new for engineering. If Compton was distressed by the refusal of commitment, Lawrence was appalled. Within 24 hours, he mailed the committee chairman a bracing challenge, edged with threat. In our meeting yesterday, there was a tendency to emphasize the uncertainties and accordingly, the possibility that uranium will not be a factor in the war. This, to my mind, was very dangerous. It will not be a calamity if, when we get the answers to the uranium problem, they turn out negative from the military point of view. But if the answers are fantastically positive and we fail to get them first, the results for our country may well be tragic disaster. I feel strongly, therefore, that anyone who hesitates on a vigorous, all-out effort on uranium assumes a grave responsibility. But Compton had already been threatened by an expert, Vannevar Bush, and knew his duty well, though he did not yet know that Bush was already committed to expedition and expansion. He had difficulty estimating the destructiveness of the bomb, The calculation involved problems of gas pressure, specific heats at hitherto unknown temperatures, the transmission of radiations and particles through the material, and forces of inertia. He asked Gregory Bright for help. Bright was even more obsessed with secrecy than Briggs. "No help was forthcoming," says Compton, gritting his teeth. He turned then to Oppenheimer. "I had known Oppie for some 14 years and had found him most competent in seeing the essentials of an intricate problem and in interpreting what he saw. So I was glad to get a letter from him with helpful suggestions." Through the end of October, Compton worked on. At Leipzig in September, Werner Heisenberg received the first 40 gallons of heavy water from Norsk Hydro and immediately prepared another chain reaction experiment like the unsuccessful effort at the virus house in Dahlem the year before. A 30-inch aluminum sphere filled with alternating layers of heavy water and uranium oxide, more than 300 pounds of it, arranged around a central neutron source. The sphere itself then immersed in water in a laboratory tank. This time, Heisenberg found some increase in neutrons, enough to extrapolate eventual success. The German laureate knew now from the work of von Weizsacker and Hautermans that a sustained chain reaction in natural uranium would breed element 94. "It was from September 1941, he remarks in consequence, "that we saw an open road ahead of us, leading to the atomic bomb." He decided to talk to Bohr. To what end he thought Bohr might help him, he never unambiguously explained. His wife Elizabeth believes he was lonely in Germany. Niels Bohr had become a father figure to him. He thought that he could talk about anything with Bohr. The advice of an older friend, more experienced in human and political affairs, had always been important to him. He saw himself confronted with the specter of the atomic bomb, Elizabeth Heisenberg explains, and he wanted to signal to Bohr that Germany neither would nor could build a bomb. Secretly, he even hoped that his message could prevent the use of an atomic bomb on Germany one day. He was constantly tortured by this idea. This vague hope was probably the strongest motivation for his trip. Heisenberg and von Weizsacker attended a scientific meeting in Copenhagen at the end of October, a meeting Bohr routinely boycotted, as he boycotted all joint Danish and German activities, to emphasize his refusal to collaborate. He was willing to see Heisenberg, however, and received him, according to the German physicist's wife, with great warmth and hospitality. Heisenberg saved his crucial conversation for a long evening walk with Bohr through the brewery district around the Carlsberg House of Honor. Being aware that Bohr was under the surveillance of the German political authorities, he recalled after the war, and that his assertions about me would probably be reported to Germany, I tried to conduct this talk in such a way as to preclude putting my life into immediate danger. Heisenberg remembers asking Bohr if it was right for physicists to work on the uranium problem in wartime, when there was a possibility that such work could lead to grave consequences in the technique of war. Bohr, who had returned from the United States convinced that a bomb was practically impossible, understood the meaning of the question immediately, as I realized from his slightly frightened reaction. Heisenberg apparently thought Bohr was privy to American secrets and was reacting guiltily to implicit exposure. But Bohr's next response suggests that he had been rather stunned at Heisenberg's revelation. He asked Heisenberg if a bomb really was possible. Heisenberg says he answered that a terrific technical effort would be necessary, which he hoped could not be realized in the present war. Bohr was shocked by my reply, obviously assuming that I had intended to convey to him that Germany had made great progress in the direction of manufacturing atomic weapons. Although I tried subsequently to correct this false impression, I probably did not succeed. I was very unhappy about the result of this conversation. Thus Heisenberg's version of the evening walk. Bohr's is less detailed. His son, Aga, a Nobel laureate in his turn and his father's successor as director of the Copenhagen Institute, summarizes it in a memoir. The impression that in Germany great military importance was given to atomic energy research was strengthened by the visit to Copenhagen in the autumn of 1941 of Werner Heisenberg and C.F. von Weizsäcker. In a private conversation with my father, Heisenberg brought up the question of the military applications of atomic energy. My father was very reticent and expressed his skepticism because of the great technical difficulties that had to be overcome. But he had the impression that Heisenberg thought that the new possibilities could decide the outcome of the war if the war dragged on. Heisenberg's account of the meeting has no basis in actual events. Robert Oppenheimer, who also had the story direct from Bohr, condenses the meeting to the comment, "Heisenberg and von Weizsäcker came over from Germany, and so did others. Bohr had the impression that they came less to tell what they knew than to see if Bohr knew anything that they did not. I believe that it was a standoff." The two accounts are not incompatible, but both leave out a crucial fact, that Heisenberg passed to Bohr a drawing of the experimental heavy water reactor he was working to build. If he did so clandestinely, he certainly risked his life. If he did so cynically and with Nazi approval to misdirect Allied intelligence, he was certainly no longer attached to Bohr as a father figure, as Elizabeth Heisenberg writes. Whatever his intent, it had the wrong effect on Bohr. Elizabeth Heisenberg thinks Bohr essentially heard only one single sentence: "The Germans know that atomic bombs could be built." He was deeply shaken by this, and his consternation was so great that he lost track of all else. But Agebohr's and Oppenheimer's accounts imply a further response from Bohr: indignation, even incredulity, that Heisenberg would think Bohr might be willing in any way, for any reason, to cooperate with Nazi Germany. Heisenberg, in turn, was aghast that Bohr would fail to see and credit his reservations, would not understand, as his wife writes, that his bond to his country and its people was not tantamount to a bond to the regime. To the contrary, she adds, Bohr told Heisenberg that he understood completely that one had to use all of one's abilities and energies for one's country in time of war. Not surprisingly, since it implied Bohr thought the worst of him, that he was willing to work for the Nazis, Heisenberg was deeply shocked by Bohr's reply. The meeting, and especially the drawing Heisenberg passed, gave Bohr more to worry about. But he continued to doubt that any nation could afford sufficient industrial capacity, especially in wartime, to pursue isotope separation. He must have been pained at what he took to be the treachery of a brilliant and formerly devoted protege. Heisenberg, for his part, found himself, says his wife, in a state of confusion and despair. Even at risk, he had not convinced Bohr of his sincerity, nor in any way begun a dialogue to avert possible catastrophe. In the absence of such dialogue, he had only managed potentially to alarm Germany's most powerful enemy further with news of progress in approaching the chain reaction. That news must necessarily accelerate Allied efforts to build a bomb. As Rudolf Pirls writes of this period in Heisenberg's life, he had agreed to sup with the devil, and perhaps he found that there was not a long enough spoon. Arthur Compton sent draft copies of the third National Academy of Sciences report to Vannevar Bush and Frank Jewett before the weekend of November 1st. The new report was brief, 6 double-spaced typewritten pages, with 49 pages of technical appendices and figures. And finally and emphatically to the point, the special objective of the present report is to consider the possibilities of an explosive fission reaction with U-235. Progress towards separating uranium isotopes, Compton wrote, made renewed consideration urgent. A rationale somewhat less than candid, British progress had spurred the change. This time the report knew what it was about. A fission bomb of superlative destructive power will result from bringing quickly together a sufficient mass of element U-235. This seems to be as sure as any untried prediction based upon theory and experiment can be. On the second page, an estimate of critical mass elicited for the first time among the three NAS reports a mention of fast fission. The mass of U-235 required to produce explosive fission under appropriate conditions can hardly be less than 2 kilograms, nor greater than 100 kilograms. These wide limits reflect chiefly the experimental uncertainty in the capture cross-section of U-235 for fast neutrons. The NAS estimate of destructiveness was low compared to the MOD report estimate, some 30 tons of TNT equivalent per kilogram of U-235. For 25 pounds, 300 tons, compared to MOD's 1,800 tons. But the American report attempted to compensate for its doubts about the efficacy of an intense energy release from a small amount of matter by emphasizing that the destructive effects on life of a bomb's radioactivity may be as important as those of the explosion itself. The centrifuge and gaseous diffusion programs were noted to be approaching the stage of practical test. Fission bombs might be available in significant quantity within 3 or 4 years. Like its predecessors, the report stressed not the German challenge, but the long-term prospect. The possibility must be seriously considered that within a few years, the use of bombs such as described here, or something similar using uranium fission, may determine military superiority. Adequate care for our national defense seems to demand urgent development of this program. In detailed appendices, Compton calculated the critical mass of a bomb heavily constrained in tamper at no more than 3.4 kilograms. Kistiakowsky debated whether a fission explosion would be as destructive in terms of energy produced as the explosion of an equivalently energetic mass of TNT, and confirmed the feasibility of firing together two pieces of uranium at a speed of several thousand feet per second. And a senior physicist on Compton's committee reported favorably on the isotope separation systems then under consideration, and recommended the principle of parallel development, meaning pursuing them all at once, an expensive way to save time in case one or more failed. Notably missing from the third report was any mention of the uranium graphite work going on at Columbia, or of plutonium. Compton remembers that a U-235 bomb looked more straightforward and more certain of accomplishment than a plutonium bomb. But the omission also measures the extent to which Briggs's judgment of priorities, and Briggs himself, had been set aside. Bush, writing Jewett before he met with Compton, had already mentioned leaving Briggs in charge of a section devoted as it is at the present time to physical measurements. Small potatoes indeed, and constituting a new group under a full-time head to handle development. He was considering Ernest Lawrence, but still thought Lawrence talked too much. The matter would have to be handled under the strictest sort of secrecy. This is the reason that I hesitate at the name of Ernest Lawrence. If the third and last NAS report only rationalized a previous presidential decision, it at least served to check the British findings independently and to commit the American physics community to the cause. The United States had finally set its wheels to the bomb track. Its inertia was proportional to the juggernaut of its scientific, engineering, and industrial might. Acceleration overcoming inertia, it now began to roll. No document Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed authenticates the fateful decision to expedite research toward an atomic bomb that